In the 1980s, the Australian government commissioned a study of the patent system. The patent system in general, not software patents. And this study concluded that Australia would be better off abolishing the patent system because it did very little good for society and caused a lot of trouble. They said, the only reason they didn't recommend that was international pressure. So one of the things they cited was that patents, which were supposed to disclose information so that it would no longer be secret, were in fact useless for that purpose. Engineers never looked at patents to try to learn anything because it's too hard to read them. In fact, they quoted an engineer saying, "I can't recognize my own inventions in patentees." Now, this is not just theoretical. A few years ago, an engineer in the US named Paul Heckel was suing Apple. He got a couple of software patents in the late 80s for a software package. And then when he saw HyperCard, he looked at it and said, "This is nothing like my program," and didn't think any more of it. But then later on, his lawyer explained to him that if you read his patents carefully, HyperCard fell into the prohibited area. So he sued Apple, figuring this is an opportunity to get some money. Well, when I gave a speech like this, he was in the audience and he said, "Oh no, that's not true. I just wasn't aware of the scope of my protection." And I said, "Yeah, that's what I said." So you're going to have to spend a lot of time working with a lawyer so that the lawyer can, explaining to the lawyer what project you're working on, so that the lawyer can explain to you what the patents imply. This is going to be expensive, and when you're done, the lawyer will tell you something like this: If you do something in this area, you're almost sure to lose a lawsuit. If you do something in this area, you're in substantial danger. And if you really want to be safe, you better stay out of this area. And of course, there's a substantial element of chance in the outcome of any lawsuit. So now that you have a predictable terrain for doing business, what are you going to do? Well, you have three options to consider. You can try to avoid the patent, you can try to license the patent, or you could try to challenge its validity in court. Any one of these three is sometimes a viable alternative and sometimes not. First, let's consider avoiding the patent. Well, in some cases, that's easy. Unisys was threatening people using the patent on LZW compression. We just had to find another data compression algorithm and we could avoid that patent. Well, that was somewhat difficult because there were many other patents covering lots of other data compression algorithms. But eventually we found one that was not in the area that those other patents covered. Eventually we did. So that program was implemented. It actually gave better compression results, and so we now have GZIP. And a lot of people use GZIP. So in that one case, it was considerable work, but we were able to do it to avoid that patent. But in the 80s, CompuServe defined an image format called GIF and used LZW compression in defining it. Well, of course, once the uproar about this patent became known, people defined another image format using a different compression algorithm. They used the GZIP algorithm, and that format is called PNG format, which I suppose means PNG is not GIF. But there was a problem. Lots of people had already started using GIF format, and there were many programs that could display GIF format and produce GIF format, and they couldn't display PNG format. So the result was people felt it was too hard to switch. You see, when you're dealing with a data compression program used by somebody who says, I want to compress some data, well, you can give him a different data compression program. You know, if he can get sued for using this one and you give him another one, he'll switch. But if what he wants to do is make images that can be displayed by Netscape, then he can't switch unless Netscape handles the other format. And it didn't. It took years, I think, before Netscape started to handle PNG format. So people essentially said, I can't switch. I just have to. And so the result was society had invested so much in this one format that the inertia was too great for a switch, even though there was another superior format available. So even when a patent is rather narrow, avoiding it can be very hard. The PostScript specification includes LZW compression, which we, in our implementation of PostScript, cannot implement. We support another kind of compression. In some sense, that is not correct, even though it does the useful job. So even a narrow patent is not always feasible to avoid. Now, sometimes a feature gets patented. In that case, you can avoid the patent by taking out that feature. In the late 80s, the users of the word processor Xyrite got a downgrade in the mail. That word processor had a feature where you could define a short word or sequence as an abbreviation. Whenever you type in that short sequence and then a space, it would turn into a longer expansion. You could define these any way you liked. Then somebody patented this, and Xyrite decided to deal with the patent by removing the feature. They contacted me because, in fact, I had put a feature like that into the original Emacs editor back in the 70s, many years before this patent. So there was a chance that I could provide evidence that would enable them to fight the patent. Well, this at least shows me that I've had at least one patentable idea in my life. I know because someone else patented it. Now, of course, you can respond to these patented features by taking the features out. But once your program starts being missing several features that users want, it might be useless as a program. Now, you may have heard of Adobe Photoshop. We have a program called the GIMP, which is more powerful in general than Photoshop. But there's one important feature that it doesn't have, which is Pantone color matching, which is very important for people who want to actually print the images on paper and get reliable results. This feature is omitted because it's patented. And as a result, the program for one substantial class of users is crippled. If you look at programs today, you'll see that they often provide many features, and the users demand these features. If any important feature is missing, well, it's easy to leave it out, but the results may be very bad. Of course, sometimes a patent is so broad that it's impossible to avoid it. Public key encryption is essential for computer users to have privacy. The whole field was patented. That patent expired just 4 years ago. There could be no free software in the US for public key encryption until then. Many programs, both free and non-free, were wiped out by the patent holders. And in fact, that whole area of computing was held back for more than a decade, despite strong interest. So, that is the possibility of avoiding the patent. Another possibility that is sometimes available is to license the patent. Now, the patent holder is not required to offer you a license. That's his whim. the patent holder can say, I'm not licensing this, you're just out of business, period. In the League for Programming Freedom, we heard in the early 90s from somebody whose family business was making casino games, computerized, of course. And he had been threatened by somebody who had a patent on a very broad category of computerized casino games. The patent covered a network where there is more than one machine, and each machine supports more than one kind of game and can display more than one game in progress at a time. Now, one thing that you should realize is the patent office thinks that it's really brilliant if you see that other people implemented doing one thing and you decide to support doing two or more. You know, if they wrote a made a system that plays one game, and if you make it able to play more than one game, that's an invention. If it can display one game and you decide to set it up so it can display two games at once, that's an invention. If he did it with one computer and you do it with a network having multiple computers, that's an invention for them. They think that these steps are really brilliant. Of course, we in computer science know that this is just a rule. You know, you can generalize anything from one to more than one. It's the most obvious principle there is. So, you know, every time you write a subroutine, that's what you're doing. So, this is one of the systematic reasons why the patent system produces and then upholds patents that we would all say are ridiculously obvious. You can't assume just because they're ridiculously obvious that they wouldn't be upheld by a court. They may be legally valid despite the fact that they're utterly stupid. So he was faced with this patent, and the patent holder was not even offering him the chance to get a license. Shut down is what the patent holder said, and that's what he eventually did. He couldn't afford to fight it. However, many patent holders will offer you the chance of a license, but it will cost you dearly. The owners of the natural order recalculation patent were demanding 5% of the gross sales of every spreadsheet. And that, I was told, was the cheap pre-lawsuit price. If you insisted on fighting over the matter, they were going to charge more. Now, you could, I suppose, sign a license like that for one patent. You could do it for two, you could do it for three, but what if there are 20 different patents in your program and each patent holder wants 5% of the gross sales? What if there are 21 of them? Then you're pretty badly screwed. But actually, business people tell me that two or three such patents would be such a big burden that you couldn't, that they would make the company fail in practice, even if in theory it might have a chance. So, a license for a patent is not necessarily a feasible thing to do. And for us free software developers, we're in an even worse position because we can't even count the copies. And most licenses demand a fee per copy. So it's absolutely impossible for us to use one of those licenses. You know, if the license charged one millionth part of a rupee for each copy, we would be unable to comply because we can't count the copies. The total amount of money I might have in my pocket, but I can't count it, so I can't pay it. So, so we suffer some special burdens occasionally. But there is one kind of organization for which licensing patents works very well, and that is the large multinational corporations. And the reason is that they own many patents themselves, and they use them to force cross-licensing. What does this mean? Well, essentially, the only defense against patents is deterrence. You have to have patents of your own, and then you hope that if somebody points a patent at you, you'll be able to point a patent back and say, don't sue me because I'll sue you. However, deterrence doesn't work as well for patents as it does with nuclear weapons. And the reason is that each patent is pointed in a fixed direction, right? It prohibits certain specified activities. So the result is that most of the companies that are trying to get some patents to defend themselves with have no chance of making this a success. Well, they might get a few patents, you know, so they might get a patent that points there, and they might get a patent that points there. Okay, and then if somebody over here threatens this company, what are they going to do? They don't have a patent pointing over there, so they have no defense. Meanwhile, sooner or later, somebody else will wander over there, and the executive of the company will think, gee, we're not as profitable as I would like. Why don't I go just squeeze some money out of them? So they say, first, we're getting these patents for defensive purposes, but they often change their minds later when a tempting victim walks by. And this, by the way, is the reason why the fallacy in the myth that the patent system, quote, protects, unquote, the, quote, small inventor, unquote. Let me tell you this myth. It's the myth of the starving genius. It's somebody who has been working in isolation for years and starving and has a brilliant new idea for how to do something or other. And so now he's starting a company and he's afraid that some big company like IBM will compete with him, and so he gets a patent, and this patent is going to, quote, protect him, unquote. Well, of course, this is not the way things work in our field. People don't make this progress in isolation this way. They're working with other people and talking with other people, and they're developing software, usually. And so the whole scenario doesn't make sense. And besides, if he's such a good computer scientist, there was no need for him to starve. He could have got a job at any time if he wanted. But let's suppose that this happened. And suppose that he has his patent and he says, IBM, you can't compete with me because I've got this patent. Well, here's what IBM says. Well, gee, let's look at your product. Well, I have this patent and this patent and this patent and this patent and this patent that your product is violating. So how about if we cross license? And the starving genius says, I haven't got enough food in my belly to fight these things, so I better give in. And so they sign a cross license, and now guess what? IBM can compete with him. He wasn't protected at all. Now, IBM can do this because they have a lot of patents. They have patents pointing here, you know, everywhere. So anybody from almost anywhere that attacks IBM is facing a standoff. A small company can't do it, but a big company can. So IBM wrote an article in, it was Think Magazine, I believe, issue number 5, 1990. That's IBM's own magazine. An article about IBM's patent portfolio. IBM said that it got two kinds of benefit from its 9,000 active US patents. One benefit was collecting royalties from licenses. But the other benefit, the bigger benefit, was access to things patented by others. Permission to not to be attacked by others, but with their patents, through cross-licensing. And the article said that the second benefit was an order of magnitude greater than the first. In other words, the benefit to IBM of being able to make things freely, not being sued, was 10 times the benefit of collecting money for all their patents. Now, the patent system is a lot like a lottery, in that what happens with any given patent is largely random, and most of them don't bring any benefit to their owners. But IBM is so big that these things average out over the scale of IBM. So you could take IBM as measuring what the average is like. What we see is, and this is a little bit subtle, the benefit to IBM of being able to make the thing, use the ideas that were patented by others, is equal to the harm that the patent system would have done to IBM if there were no cross-licensing.